Welcome back to Word and Table, a bi-weekly podcast on liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship and why it is vital in our world today. I'm your host, Alex Wilgus, and I am here, as always, with Father Stephen Gauthier. Welcome back, Father Stephen.
Great to be back, Alex.
Father Stephen is the canon theologian of the Diocese of the Upper Midwest in the Anglican Church in North America, and he is director of formation at St. Paul's House of Formation in the Greenhouse Movement. Hey, Father Stephen, I thought we could talk about another Latin father, St. Jerome, who I got to confess, I don't know a whole lot about. I know him as a really serious scholar who produced the Latin Vulgate translation of the Bible. So I thought we could just dive into his life, his career, his major works, and maybe give people a little bit of a guide about how to go about reading and appreciating Jerome. Maybe we can begin with this early.
Alex, that's a good choice. Jerome is an amazing man who's made a great contribution. He's a special interest to Anglicans. There's really a unique side to Jerome that is very interesting to Anglicans.
I always leave it to you to pull out what's of interest to Anglicans. I'm excited. So.
What are the chances with an Anglican priest?
Exactly. Well, let's begin with his early life. Let's put him on the timeline.
Well, he was born in what today we call Slovenia, you know, where you a part of the old Yugoslavia, in the 4th century. He was born, basically about 2 decades after the Council of Nicaea. And he studied in Rome, and he did first thing he did that tells us which way he's heading. As he masters Greek, you see, back in the early days, everybody in the upper classes knew Greek. Mm-hmm. So in the very earliest, as a matter of fact, in the church in Rome, Greek was the language of worship into the 3rd century.
Yeah.
But that dies out. So ironically, in the earliest church, the heart of people who actually use Latin primarily with scholarship things is North Africa. Mm-hmm. But in Rome and things, people use Greek. They of course, know Latin, but Greek is the language of scholarship and things.
Interesting. Okay.
And so what happens, though, by this time, that's not true anymore.
Okay.
You're going to find people who just don't know Greek. I mean, like Augustine, for example, his Greek is questionable how much he ever knew. Uh-huh. But he actually masters Greek, does a really good job of mastering Greek. He studies literature, rhetoric, which is the classic thing, the sort of liberal arts of the ancient world, and philosophy. Mm-hmm. He's an excellent student. He then goes to Trier, which is an important imperial city in Germany. Where he studies theology and became attracted to the monastic life. So his early career, where he goes, is he starts out for 7 years in Aquileia. It's in northeast Italy. Okay, think towards Venice, around there, east of Venice. And then what's going to change his life is he takes a trip out to the Holy Land, that area, and Egypt, the Holy Land. And remember, that's the heartland of monasticism. Mm-hmm. And he's really won over. He actually directly experienced real monks in the desert.
Yeah.
He's really impressed.
This seems like a common theme with men of that century.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were considered really the shock troops.
Yeah.
If you want to see it really done, those are the native speakers of Christian. Mm-hmm. They had really great respect for these guys. Now that we no longer had martyrs, they were sort of the equivalent of the martyrs.
I see.
You know, they're the ones who are really going to the end. He now perfected his Greek, and then he did something dramatic. He learned Hebrew, and he learned it well.
Okay.
He studied with a rabbi, and the fact that he thought it was really important to learn Hebrew. Now, one thing we should understand is that was very unusual. Why would someone want to learn Hebrew? We'd say, well, it's obvious with the Bible.
Yeah.
But actually what had happened is, remember, the quotes in the New Testament are often taken from the Greek version of the Bible,
right.
Septuagint, the Bible of the 70. And often that disagrees with the Hebrew text. And so to this day, the Eastern Orthodox Church considers the Greek Bible to be the authoritative by reading the Hebrew text.
Yeah.
But he really wants to go directly to the Hebrew text.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks it's really important to study in the Hebrew. He's actually ordained a priest. He goes to Constantinople, sort of finishes up his studies there, and he's attracted by Gregory Nazianzus, one of our friends,
one
of the Cappadocians. And Nazianzus is a great preacher, great rhetorician. And so he listens to the sermons, and he's really impressed. And from them, he learns biblical exegesis. Mm-hmm. And he actually gets to know the works of Origen, who we need to talk about. He's an amazing, amazing thinker at that time, one of the greatest Christian thinkers of all time. So he goes back to Rome, and for 3 years, we have a really remarkable time that's going to change everything for him. He becomes secretary to Pope Damasus. And here's what's neat about that. He responds to letters. He's sort of, you know, the guy who responds to letters, you know, dear.
Yeah.
And so he gets makes a lot of connections because he's the one who does the correspondence. And he's also, the Pope said, you know, they had very poor, what they did, the Latin Bible, it's called the Vetus Latina, is the old Latin, was really a haphazard thing that people did translations of this or that, a very uneven quality from earlier times. And the Pope said, we really need a good Latin version of the Bible.
Huh, okay.
A really good, and you seem to be the man, because he had, obviously had a linguistic gift. His Greek was fabulous. Had a linguistic gift. While he's in Rome, he gets a lot of trouble. For some reason, he was the most popular spiritual director for women. They love the guy.
Really?
But it wasn't like that. There's nothing of the romantic about
him. So he's not like a ladies' man?
No, okay. Ladies' man.
Okay.
But he...
that's probably why they liked him.
No, he wasn't that. He was a tough guy, but he just wasn't interested. But they loved him. He was actually very dramatic about how hard this had to be.
Uh-huh.
And especially three of them, Marcella, Paola, and Eustochium, despite that name, that's a woman's name, they become very important. These are wealthy women seem to be particularly interested. They sort of live a quasi-monastic life, and they'll actually follow him to the Holy Land when he goes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But Jerome, when I think of the Church Fathers, I think he's the two least likable Church Fathers on a human level. the hands down winner is Cyril of Alexandria.
Okay.
Truly unlikable.
Kind of a pill.
Oh, gee. I mean, God, but I mean, truly. Cyril is a hard man. But Jerome really had a sharp tongue, and he was really good at insults and things.
When he
took you on, he's like, you know, a pit bull. He would not let go. And he could turn on a friend, he'd just turn, and when he goes at you, you're out.
Really? Wow.
He was a real
kind of irascible guy.
Well, he would go after moral lapses and things.
I see. So if like someone had sinned or something, he really would.
You don't want him on your case.
Okay.
Okay. Imagine a Twitter mob.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Fourth century Twitter mob.
So then what happens? He's doing great for 3 years. Everything's going well. And then Pope Damasus, this is thoughtless. He dies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think Jerome actually might have thought, a lot of people think he might have thought given his lack of political skills, was not a candidate.
Okay, so he's not in line for Pope, and then when Damasus dies, this is his
it's
kinda,
over.
His main patron, kind of, okay.
Well, you know, a basic rule is, you know, for example, in political life is, when you're, I mean, like an office politics type of thing. If you go after a job, let's suppose some of your boss goes down. If you go after the job and there's an outsider, the normal rules of engagement are, if you don't go for the job, then you have a chance you might survive when the new guy comes in.
Yeah.
But if you go for the job, you're a combatant.
Yeah. That's
you see,
true.
You can hope to survive as a non-combatant, but if you go in, you got to win.
I see. Okay. Okay. Shoot to kill.
Yeah. If you're a combatant.
Yeah.
But in any event, he is so out. He's made a lot of enemies in Rome.
Okay.
A lot of people don't like Jerome.
Uh-huh.
And to read his letters, you'll find out why.
Uh-huh.
He's a pretty sharp guy, and he's very effective too. He's really funny. He's a good. Yeah. He's really good. He's really stinging.
Yeah.
But he goes to Bethlehem. And he establishes monasteries there for men and women. And he continues his study, his in-depth study of Hebrew and Aramaic. And his principal work is going to be the standard. Vulgus means for the people, just regular people are Vulgus. And Vulgate simply means a Bible for the people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing work. It's sometimes people say it's Church Latin. They're wrong. It's classical Latin. It's a later site of classical Latin, but it is not at all like medieval Latin. It's very classical.
Okay.
But it's more like, if you know, for our Latinists out there, is even classical Latin wasn't classical Latin in this sense. Like Cicero wrote the most ornate Latin. He's the great stylist.
Okay.
But when you read his actual letters, they're very different Latin. It's like we
I see.
And so it's more like that. It's more like Cicero's letters.
Okay.
It's very readable. It's a very faithful translation, but not slavish. He thought it was important to make it Latin, you know, not to make it unreadable.
I see, yeah.
And it was a combination of revisions to existing things, new trials. He puts this all together. And also he has extensive involvement in the life of the church while he's here. So Bethlehem, the main thing he's doing is working on the Bible and other translations of theology. Like, again, he could translate now these Greek things into Latin for
his
friends back home who aren't very good in Greek.
But he's not neglecting church controversies at the same time?
No, there's he could never let a controversy go. That's just not who Jerome is, ever.
He's got an opinion on everything.
There's no way that man's going to miss a controversy. Sadly, he brought down, he was the one who really got involved in the takedown of Origin.
I see. Yeah. Okay.
He really led that effort. And so his works, we have a lot of translations, wonderful scriptural commentaries. He's really a serious scholar. We have the first history of Christian literature. You know how, like, when you read Eusebius's Ecclesiastical, you'll say, hey, somebody wrote this book and give you things. Jerome did systematically. Here's everything I know of that's been written in the church.
Wow. Okay.
It's really neat. Yeah. He wrote a history of that called De Viris Illustribus, you know, about of famous men, but it's really a literary history of Christianity. Uh-huh. And letters are of great historical interest. He knew everybody. He was in every fight. And so, I mean, it's just a wonderful, it's like having the best seat at a football game.
Okay.
You see everything in his letters.
Yeah.
And he was a really great writer. His Latin is great.
I see.
And so his letters, if you're a Latinist, are really good to read. They're just really well written.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Now you say, how does this all fit in to being an Anglican?
Yeah, yeah. What's the special interest in
Anglicanism? Two things about that. Is one is he was the one who really latched on, is I think the Hebrew, the original text, is what's authoritative. He called it the Hebraica Veritas,
mm-hmm.
the Hebrew truth.
Yeah.
You know, that was authoritative. He would not buy the idea the Greek Bible was some. No, it was written, inspired in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
So he really hooked on to the original language. This is important. Remember Wycliffe, one of our first reformers, you know, sort of the precursor of the Reformation in England.
Sure.
Well, based on his lack of skills, technically, he's a good man, but he just translated the Vulgate.
Yeah.
You know, that
yeah.
kind of thing you translate, but he said, no, I think we need to go back to the original texts.
Okay.
So that's a very big deal with Jerome, and he had the scientific knowledge to do it. He was really a good Hebraicist. He was a good Hellenist.
Uh-huh.
He's a good scholar. And also, what do you do? He discovered in doing that, that a number of the books in the Greek version of the Old Testament are not in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought this was really important.
Hmm.
And so he clearly thought it was important to distinguish those books which were shared by Jews and Christians from those which are not in the Hebrew Bible.
I see.
Some very popular books like the Book of Wisdom of Jesus, son of Sirach,
mm-hmm.
Is there, that's one of the most, it became known as Ecclesiasticus because it's sort of, I like to call it, it's the Book of Proverbs on steroids. It's enormously practical advice and things. And they used it, they called it the church book in Latin, Ecclesiasticus,
mm-hmm.
because people come into Christianity and tell them how you live a Christian life. It just gave very practical advice on living a good moral life.
Yeah.
It was
yeah.
very popular. The Book of Wisdom, the Wisdom of Solomon, is very popular in things.
Uh-huh.
And he says those are valuable books, but we can't look at them as being in the same realm as the Hebrew scriptures. So he'd always warn you, say, hey, when he's doing his translation, say, these books now here, this is here, this portion of this book is not in the Hebrew.
Okay.
So we're still going to give it to you. They can be valuable, but they're not to be confused.
Yeah.
And that's how our solution at the Reformation, these books had been read in church and valued for that time of 1,500 years
mm-hmm.
in East and West. So we kept the books, but we made the same distinction. We don't set doctrine on them. They're good That's what he said. They're good for example
mm-hmm.
and, you know, advice, but they're not a foundation. So he basically gave us what we ran with at the Reformation, saying, Jerome, a great man, has already dealt with this issue,
mm-hmm.
and that's the solution we came up with.
I see. So we're indebted to him for drawing that first distinction between
Apocrypha. He was the one who really made it definitive in the West. It's the Hebrew that counts for the Old Testament, and that there's a difference, and that we have to look at those books differently. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of them, he wasn't about to throw them out. They, after all, had been used by the church for hundreds of years by that time, the whole church. But they're not the same thing.
Well, great. Is there anything else you have for us on Jerome?
It's amazing. You know, sometimes you look back at what's called scholarship in previous times.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, sometimes we're, you know, like we look at medical scholarship or something, we
kind of chuckle at it, yeah.
What's amazing when you look back at Jerome is his actual, what we call scientific knowledge in linguistics and things, is really good. I mean, for his time, it's incomparable. You know, he really is. That's why he's so valued, that people realize this guy really has very, very technical skills.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
You know, as far as dealing with the texts and things that are invaluable.
Yeah, yeah, I see.
He made a great contribution to the church. Okay. And again, I don't want to overplay. He was, you just need to, because part of history, he was difficult. But sometimes artists can be that way.
Sorry. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Very talented.
Very brilliant people.
He's a very brilliant man.
Be a little difficult to deal with.
And it often was friends. He'd be close with somebody, like Rufinus and things. We're best of friends. And then something goes wrong, and...
Yeah, it's just all over.
Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah, well... Maybe follow the example of his learning, but not so much his personality.
His gift to the church, to all of us, is immeasurable.
Mm-hmm.
And again, for those of you who know Latin, the definitive form is the 16 Vulgate is the definitive form of it. It's a really good translation. I recommend it to you.
Great.
But not to confuse with the Nova Vulgata, the New Vulgate.
Uh-huh.
Which isn't Jerome's work.
Okay.
They put out a new Latin version of the Bible in the Catholic Church called the New Vulgate, which is based on the most modern scholarship and things.
I see.
That would not be the Vulgate of Jerome.
Okay, I see. So
the Nova Vulgata is not the Jerome's Vulgate.
Okay, I see. Great.
But that's really new in the sense it's didn't exist when I was a kid.
Uh-huh. Wow.
We're still using Jerome's Vulgate.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty new. Yeah, if it fell in your lifetime. I guess that's pretty new.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's very kind.
Well, thanks so much, Father Stephen. That's all the time we have left for this episode. Thank you for listening to Word and Table. We'll be back in a couple weeks for more on liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship. Thanks for listening.